For the Brennan Center for Justice, I'm Victoria Bassetti, and this is The Line. In the weeks to come, we're taking a close look at critical issues about voting in America.
So many cities are corrupt, and voter fraud is all too common. And then they say, oh, there's no voter fraud in our country. There's no voter fraud. No, there's no voter fraud.
It's one of the hottest topics of 2016, the fear of massive voter fraud. Poll after poll shows a growing discomfort, a profound distrust in our election system. The Brennan Center produced a comprehensive report on voter fraud. Here's some of the stuff we looked at. Dead voters, double voting, felon voting, non-citizen voting, vote buying, election official fraud, registration fraud. We even looked at whether dogs voted. And we found fraud incidence rates between 0.00004% and 0.0009%. I put the question to Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice. So, Michael, is the election rigged?
No, the election is not rigged.
Why do you think people are so receptive to the argument that the election is going to be rigged?
I think people generally are skeptical about politics, about government, about the rough deal they might have had from the system. So they're open to the idea that, well, why wouldn't there be this kind of misconduct? But as a factual matter, there isn't, and it's really, really hard to do, even if you wanted to.
Well, I think I could rig the election. I've got a few ideas, so I'm going to run them by you. Maybe you can tell me if I've got a good idea. So I've got 15 kids. They're really good with computers. They promise me they're going to be able to hack into the machines and change the results.
Well, the machines are not connected to the internet, so they would have a hard time doing that.
Okay. I got about $10,000. I'm willing to go buy a bunch of votes. How about that?
Well, we vote in secret this century and the last one, too. So there's no way to know, actually, if people are going to cast the votes you want them to cast.
How about I've got a bunch of friends who are willing to pretend to be other people. They're going to go to the polls and they're going to cast a bunch of extra votes.
If you show up pretending to be someone else, it's illegal. You're risking thousands of dollars in fines and years in prison to cast one extra vote. A federal judge said that anyone who would do that would have to be insane. And in fact, every bit of evidence shows that that kind of voter impersonation is vanishingly rare. And actually, you're more likely to be hit by lightning in the United States than to commit that kind of voter fraud.
So that's not a good idea. How about absentee ballots? What if I get a bunch of absentee ballots, I apply for them and fill them out for someone else?
You're onto something. The greatest risk of election misconduct comes from absentee ballots, where we don't have as many safeguards. That's why early voting in person and other in-person voting is probably the most secure thing we have.
Now, we'll take a look at the real risks of fraud by absentee ballot in a moment. But to understand why the voting fraud story resonates so deeply with the American public, we need to go back in time to the heart of all of those colorful stories of political corruption and election theft. It's a brick building squatting on the corner of Union Square and 17th Street in Manhattan. Today, it's boarded up. It's got store closing signs, faded vodka posters from a defunct liquor store, the remnants of a deli. It may not look like much, but this was Tammany Hall, the ultimate symbol of fraud and voter abuse in the 19th century. I went there to meet Terry Golway, a historian and a journalist with Politico. He's also the author of Machine Made, Tammany Hall, and the Creation of Modern American Politics.
And here he is.
Hi there.
So this is Tammany Hall.
This is it, yes. It's a magnificent building. You know, when you look at it, you see how sturdy it was built, and it's sort of built on a almost monumental scale. Obviously, they thought they would be here a long time, and the irony being, it opened in 1929. By 1943, it was closed. Tammany Hall is often misunderstood. It actually is a building, which I think people find hard to believe, but it really is shorthand. Tammany Hall meant the Democratic County Committee of New York County, Manhattan. So it was basically the Democratic Party, and it was a society to which many of the members belonged, the Society of St. Tammany. Therefore, the place where they met became known as Tammany Hall.
But in Tammany Hall, in popular imagination, it's a byword for corruption and voter fraud.
And with good reason, because it was corrupt. And it engaged in voter fraud, for sure. One of the ways in which a great power in Tammany Hall, a guy named Richard Croker, one of the ways he gained fame and power is the fact that he could be counted on to vote multiple times on Election Day. He loved to vote. He liked democracy.
That 1868 election, the one where Croker voted multiple times, it's sort of legendary in the history of Tammany Hall and voter fraud. I've heard about these immigration mills that Tammany Hall was running. What was that about?
Well, that sort of shows the good side and the bad side of Tammany. Tammany came to power or achieved its path to power with the arrival of immigrants. They didn't judge immigrants. The nativists looked at immigrants and saw them as uneducated, as un-American, as foreign. The machine said, we don't care how they worship God. Maybe they don't even worship God. We don't care what language they speak. All we care about is, will they come out and vote for us? So by offering them jobs, by offering them something as simple and as complicated as cultural respect, they earned the loyalty of these immigrants. And immigration caused great disruption in New York City in the 1840s and 1850s. This was the height of the Know-Nothing movement. And there were political parties, the Whigs, and even the early Republicans were very anti-immigrant. Tammany, on the other hand, welcomed immigrants, and helped change the power dynamics in New York by recruiting these immigrants, by inviting them to participate.
So a lot of those Tammany Hall votes that we're talking about, they were legit votes. It wasn't like Tammany Hall was getting out 100,000 completely fake votes. Most of Tammany Hall votes were for real.
Absolutely. And when you look at the electoral catastrophes that they suffered, particularly in the early 20th century, if they were stealing elections, they weren't very good at it because they lost a lot. I mean, the idea of a machine sort of churning out voter after voter and victory after victory doesn't square with the record. So in 1868, or so the legend goes, Tammany basically naturalized as many immigrants as possible and supposedly stole elections as a result of these fraudulent naturalizations.
After 1868, Tammany Hall continued to build a reputation for stealing elections. What else did they do?
For example, in 1905, in a very hotly contested mayoral election, in which it looked like the newspaper publisher William Randolph Hearst was going to win on a third-party line, it was said that boxes of ballots were found in the East River and the Hudson River, and that was why Hearst lost. It certainly was why Hearst thought he lost. But that was one example where supposedly Tammany inspectors just threw out the votes.
In the late 19th century and early 20th century, the progressive movement began reforming our election system. And that, to a certain degree, inhibited Tammany Hall, but it also significantly decreased turnout, didn't it?
Yes, because the professionalization of politics sort of took some of the fun out of it. And what Tammany understood is that politics is about passion. It's about self-interest. It's not always about what is the common good. I mean, it would be great if we could all vote that way. But Tammany understood that to turn out the vote, people need to know what's in it for them. And that actually was the magic of Tammany Hall, is that they stripped democracy of a lot of the bromides of the founding fathers. You know, this idea that, you could deliver a vote that was dispassionate and disinterested. Tammany said no. They understood people wanted to know how politics could help them, particularly if you were poor and all you had was your vote. Well, why wouldn't you bargain with it?
So we're standing in front of this building, the last Tammany Hall. It's boarded up. It's got plywood with graffiti all over it. It's got warning construction signs. Tammany Hall couldn't steal a box of Kleenex if it wanted to today.
No.
It couldn't steal a pack of gum.
No.
But lawyers, courts, when they're looking for evidence of corruption, cite Tammany Hall.
Well, it's what they learn in school. I mean, I don't think there's a U.S. 1 history book, and I used to be a history professor. I don't think there's a history book about this era that doesn't have the words Tammany Hall. So it becomes a common reference point. Now, the fact is, there were far more corrupt machines in other cities, but other cities aren't New York.
Terry Golway, thank you so much for your time and for standing with us on a street corner in Manhattan, a noisy street corner in Manhattan in front of an old boarded-up building.
It's always a pleasure to be in the shadow of Tammany Hall.
Historian Terry Golway. Since Tammany Hall faded into irrelevance more than 80 years ago, our election systems have been modernized and professionalized. There are extensive laws and regulations, ways to cross-check and audit the vote. We have sophisticated vote counting equipment. And there are tens of thousands of election officials whose job it is to look out for fraud and prosecute it. I spoke to one of them, Michael Brandy. He's the executive director and general counsel of the State Elections Enforcement Commission for Connecticut. He keeps a spreadsheet of all of his election fraud cases.
The spreadsheet is a basic compilation of all the cases that this agency has prosecuted since 1974 that involve the fraudulent voting statute here in Connecticut. And I can tell you there's 97 cases we have prosecuted in that time frame which involve some level of voter fraud.
That's over 40 years, right?
Over 40 years. And the concept of in-person voter fraud in Connecticut, I can tell you that there's not a single case on our spreadsheet that involves in-person showing up at the polls and impersonating another person. There's not a single case in the state of Connecticut in the last 40 years.
So you don't have a Tammany Hall operating in Connecticut nowadays, do you?
No, we don't.
No. Would it be possible for Tammany Hall to be operating in Connecticut?
I think that there's different types of operations that can exist that could be fraudulent, and I would say those are primarily dealing with absentee ballots. If somebody's got a really creative scheme for, you know, collecting these ballots or otherwise intimidating people to vote in certain ways, where you could basically influence, you know, dozens of ballots from a single location. Those are kind of cases that we're very cautious of and we watch out for. But that's the closest I think you can get to kind of a Tammany Hall operation in today's environment.
Is it a problem in Connecticut? Do you face absentee ballot, you know, kind of those mills that are operating? Is that something that you see or worry about?
We do see them. We do worry about them. But we are a pretty strong enforcement agency, and we see those cases, and when they're reported to us, we have taken swift action.
So one of the things is that conspiracies tend to get caught.
They do.
Because in order for them to be meaningful, you've got to start getting a lot of people involved.
I completely agree. And what we've found in the course of, you know, our investigative process is generally there's always somebody that's going to talk. I can't relate all of our techniques that we utilize, but we do have very good investigators. We're in the age of millennials who are always texting and emailing, and there's lots of ways for us to get information that people might not think is very relevant, but at the end sometimes is critical to prosecuting these cases.
So tell me about some of the specific absentee ballot mills or, you know, kind of abuse cases that you've dealt with.
Sure. One of the cases recently and actually involved a sitting state representative who was involved in influencing voters who had taken out absentee ballot applications and been given their ballots. And she was actually instructing them how to vote on their absentee ballots. And she did this in a public place, in an office in a town hall where people reported it to us because they heard the conversations and they saw what was going on. We also have a statute here in Connecticut that we think helps to prevent some of those incidents. And it's a supervised absentee ballot process. It's usually in more of the larger urban environments where vulnerable populations might exist in, say, a nursing home or a rest home, an assisted living facility. And what happens in those situations is the polling place conducted through the registrar's office actually comes out to those locations. And under our statute, if 20 or more absentee ballot requests come from the same address, same building, the registrars or voters are empowered to make a discretionary decision to invoke supervised absentee ballot at that location. Much more secure than a ballot being mailed to those locations where there's the risk that somebody might intercept them or otherwise influence a voter.
Let's say I'm really worried about the election and I've decided I'm going to do it. I'm going to vote 10 times on election day. Walk me through it. How would I do that? What would step one be if I wanted to vote 10 times in Connecticut?
The truth is, you wouldn't be able to vote 10 times. When you appear at the polling place, you've already registered to vote, so you're on the voting rolls. When you show up at the polling place, you're going to be asked to provide some form of identification. Not photo ID, but some form of identification. If you have nothing with you at all, Connecticut has a process where you could fill out an affidavit, and through that affidavit, you'd be given a ballot. Now, it's a provisional ballot at that point because they have to certify that you are, in fact, the person and you are voting in the right district, and it's you on the voter rolls. To show up and try to impersonate somebody, I'm just not sure how you would do that. You are still required to give some type of identification. It could be a phone bill. It could be your electric bill with a credit card with your signature on it. It's usually multiple kinds of identification that you need to provide to verify that the person that's on the voter rolls is you.
Now, so if I wanted to do it, I suppose the first thing I need to do is find the names of some other registered people. Mm-hmm. And I'd also have to be reasonably certain that they weren't themselves going to show up that day.
Right. So you have to make sure they're not already there to vote. And you're also going to have to somehow acquire some type of identification to show that Jane Doe, who lives at 23 Smith Street, you have some form of identification, whether it's your utility bills that you've somehow had to acquire. It would be a real process to try to engage and steal one vote. And that's probably
the
reason.
And then if you caught me, what would you do to me?
If we caught you, you'd be subject to the criminal violations of voter fraud. Under 9-360, fraudulent voting would subject you to a fine of somewhere between $300 and $500 and a jail sentence of between 1 and 2 years. To risk that, to vote for one person and impersonate one person, doesn't seem to me to be a great, the cost benefit there doesn't seem to match up.
So why all of this push for strict voter ID that you hear about across the United States?
Great question. Looking in the state of Connecticut, we're just simply not seeing these types of voter impersonation situations. We don't know why a photo ID would be required. To me, it's the proverbial solution in search of a problem here. And it's something that would be more akin to voter suppression here than it would be preventing fraud.
1.7 million votes are probably going to be cast in Connecticut this November. How many of them are going to be fraudulent?
My best guess, it's going to be very little and very few. Because we have a strong enforcement regime in Connecticut, we tend to have pretty much a strong deterrent effect here. And so I don't expect to see very much, if any, at all.
So how afraid should people be that the system is rigged?
I think that's a fallacy. The system is not rigged. We have in Connecticut 169 cities and towns, dozens of polling places within those cities and towns. I just don't see with a dispersed effect like that of how our polling places operate, I just don't see how the system could be rigged.
That was Michael Brandy, Chief Elections Enforcement Officer for the state of Connecticut. As Brandy noted, absentee ballots can be a weak spot. Connecticut keeps on top of it with supervised voting. To get the national picture, I spoke with John Fortier. He's the director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Fortier is also the author of Absentee and Early Voting, Trends, Promises, and Perils. Before we started, I asked him to tell me about the first time he voted.
I did vote first time by absentee voting, which is kind of ironic in that later I wrote a book which was a little bit critical of voting by mail, but I was away at college. I voted from my home state of Massachusetts, but I voted in the District of Columbia. I had to find the school registrar to act as my notary public, and it was a very traditional old school absentee where I had to show the ballot to the registrar. It was blank. I stood over to the side. I filled it out. I closed the envelope. I signed it, and then I had her sign on top of my signature. So that was my first time voting was by absentee.
The way John Fortier voted demonstrates the link states often go to prevent fraud. Election officials have been worried about it from the very beginning. Let's go back to the Civil War for a second, though, and the development of the maybe it's not absentee ballot, but the first effort to get people to vote when they weren't near their home or near their polling station. You would think it might be a non-political issue, but in fact, politics got involved almost from the get-go with absentee voting.
It absolutely did. You had in each state some question about which party it would help. I think most people believed it would help the Union side and Lincoln and the Republicans in their re-election. The soldiers who were away were supportive of Lincoln. So there was that. And then there were also a lot of questions about the method and security, and different things were tried. Sometimes it looked like we do today, that a ballot showed up and they needed to get some signatures and then send it back home. But there were also experiments with allowing somebody back home to cast a vote for you. It was an experiment among the states that they put in place in a crisis situation of the war.
But then, as you say, in the 20th century, the more modern era of absentee voting evolved after World War I and then leading up to the 1970s when California really kind of opened the floodgates for absentee balloting.
Well, after the Civil War, absentee voting was not a major feature for a while. But we did have another set of reforms that came in, and that was the so-called Australian ballot or the secret ballot that was put in place. Late in the 19th century, almost every state looked across to Australia and the UK, who had been adopting these private ballots. They worried that big city machines were stuffing ballots, that many people depended on voting the right way to keep their job or to get some reward. They would show up with a blue ballot that everyone could see to make sure they were supporting the right party. And when we put these restrictions in, which said the state produces the ballot, not outsiders, and you have a privacy booth so nobody ultimately knows how you can vote, that became a very important feature, which was enshrined in state constitutions and was an important factor in voting. So then 30 years later, when the states say, well, we want to allow some absentee voting, they say, well, we've got these restrictions in our constitution sometimes or in law that say you must have privacy of the vote. And for those states to say you're just going to send a ballot out to who knows where someone could see it, where something could happen to it, they wanted to put restrictions in that would duplicate as much as possible the privacy of the polling booth. So that's the reason why many times you would actually have to go to a notary public and show your blank ballot and then stand off to the side so that the notary could see no one was watching you or influencing your vote and then sign on the absentee. So all of these restrictions we think of perhaps as arcane came about because of that secret ballot revolution in the 19th century.
It was like the legacy of Tammany Hall hanging over the way we voted well into the 20th century.
It was. And the changes that then occurred later in California first in the late 70s, you know, that had receded in people's minds, worried less about the privacy of the vote and thinking, well, this is a difficult procedure for people to enact. And so California really wiped away some of those restrictions. But some states still do have a reason or requirement. The state of Virginia has a number of reasons. Many of them, you know, they're fairly generous, but there's 17 different reasons, or there are a large number of reasons in Virginia, and there are some other states that still require you to actually have a reason. There are still some states that require you to still have a witness or perhaps a notary public. Those are restrictions that have been dying out but are still there in some states.
And some states have even gone so far as to move to almost completely absentee voting, mail voting.
That's absolutely right. So the Western states, by and large, were the early adopters of voting by mail, absentee voting. And the state of Oregon had moved very far down the road where a large percentage of its citizens were voting by mail, and in the late 80s decided to go ahead and move to a system where essentially they're voting all by mail.
It's interesting because when you talk to people who are concerned about fraud or rigging elections or stealing elections, there's a lot of dispute about in-person impersonation. There doesn't seem to be a lot of substantial concern about other modes of fraud, you know, throwing ballots into the river, extensive voter intimidation. But everyone seems to sort of then say, but there is a potential for absentee ballot fraud. If there's any kind of weak spot in our system, that's it.
I think that is the weakest spot. And well, why did we want to have the secret ballot in the first place? And it's because there's something good about the privacy of a polling place, and also the less worries about the transmission or third parties being involved. If you have a polling place that is watched over by state officials, that provides the ballot, that gives you privacy, sure, there are some very hard ways of getting around that. But it really does close off a lot of the avenues that you see in vote by mail. So I don't think we have a large problem in vote by mail. I think in many ways our country does not have an extensive problem in these areas. But I think there is more potential for it in there, and we should be careful. States that want to move that way should do some things to care about the privacy and the transmission of ballots, or they might consider other options which are more like a polling place, like an early voting polling place.
And every once in a while we find these kind of tiny mills operating, you know, 20 or 30 ballots that have been gathered by a political operative in a nursing home or at a student center or something like that. But it's usually pretty small numbers, right?
It does. From what we can tell, it seems to be relatively small numbers, and some of the worries we have are sometimes for very small and local races, which are off the radar screen, where, you know, 40 votes might be very important for a sheriff's race in a small town. And if someone has a scheme going where they're able to actually affect absentee ballots in that case, it really, really does make a big effect. But there's no evidence that there is a wide-scale organized effort that has thousands or tens of thousands of votes affected.
So I couldn't change the outcome of the presidential election by running an absentee ballot scheme, could I?
Well, tell me how close that election is. If any election is really close, then some of those things around the edges make a difference. But it would be very hard to have an organized scheme in many places run by the same people.
Is there anything like Tammany Hall today? Could a Tammany Hall operate in the 21st century?
Well, I don't think there's something of the extent of Tammany Hall. I mean, the idea of political machines bringing new immigrants and people into the process of voting in America, making them Americans essentially. On the other hand, they were very, very controlling organizations which required loyalty and required you to cast your vote in the right way. I think we could see aspects of this. We could certainly see small groups of people saying, look, we should all be together on certain issues and it's really important. So therefore, it would be great to make sure that we cast our ballots the right way. There could be some outright pressure that comes from a domineering spouse or a boss that has some power over you. I mean, I don't think this is a large institutional thing that we will be seeing, but I do think that there are those kinds of pressures. And the privacy of the ballot, which really was developed after the Civil War in the late 19th century and is very important background for a lot of our voting today, some of these concerns are valid, that you want to protect voters who have some pressure on them. And so not the full Tammany Hall, but certainly aspects of it can be seen in our society.
That was John Fortier of the Bipartisan Policy Center. Let's go back one more time to Michael Waldman. So if I can't hack the machines, if I can't send a bunch of people around to the polls to vote multiple times, if I can't buy an election, how am I going to rig it? Can I rig it?
No, you can't. And this charge is utter nonsense. The idea that somehow mysteriously there's massive voter misconduct, switching elections that none of us can see and none of us can point to and that none of us have actually noticed happening is just absurd. And it's quite malicious in many ways. It undermines, of course, faith in democracy. It undermines the legitimacy of the outcome of elections. And it gives people the sense that someone else, somewhere else, must be stealing votes. Republicans and Democrats have agreed that the elections aren't rigged, that the outcomes are going to be fair. That's actually now something that both parties are agreeing on, and I hope that that can lead to more agreement on what to do about our elections.
Look, if nothing else, people are going to be watching on November 8th. Watch Philadelphia. Watch St. Louis. Watch Chicago. Watch so many other places.
When Donald Trump says in suburban or rural political rallies, well, people in Philadelphia, people in other places, you know the neighborhoods I mean, they're committing voter fraud and sign up to be poll watchers. He's encouraging vigilantism in a very terrifying way. When Rudy Giuliani says that it's people in inner cities who commit voter fraud, I don't think anybody has to think too hard about what he's saying. It's an ugly remnant of a long gone past, and the only way to really overcome it is for people to show up and vote and show that the American democracy is strong and the elections aren't rigged.
Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of The Line. And for more on voting rights, visit us at brennancenter.org. Special thanks to Scripps Howard and Decode DC for their help in the production of this podcast. In the coming days before this election, we'll be releasing new episodes on voting rights. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast to get upcoming episodes on strict voter ID and voter turnout as soon as they're released. For the Brennan Center for Justice, I'm Victoria Bassetti.